Welcome once again, dear listeners, to Food Conversations Season 7. Before we begin, as always, we must not forget that we are living and working on Skrepakulu, the ancestral, unceded, and actually stolen lands of the Skrepak people, and it's clear that doing everything we can to resolve this situation is an important and necessary responsibility for every one of us. Now, today I'm truly delighted to welcome back to Food Conversations a guest who joined us a couple of months ago and whose insights then, and undoubtedly today as well, about our relationship with the natural world and our collective future are important and valuable. Keith Williams is officially an assistant professor of educational studies at Athabasca University, as well as an adjunct professor at the First Nations Technical Institute located on Tiendanaga, Mohawk territory in what we now call Ontario. More importantly, he has deep roots into Indigenous culture and has much to offer us, all of us, as we gaze into the future and look for solutions to today's existential crises. Welcome back, Keith, to Food Conversations.
Thank you so much, Warren. It's a pleasure to be here.
I was thinking lots of things before the show, and just really, truly going over some of the material that I gathered after we'd had our conversation before the show, mm-hmm. and it just deepened my sense that we're going to be talking about stuff that really, really matters today. When you were on the show before, we began to talk about the notion of plants and other life forms as both food and medicine, and we particularly talked about fungi, the class of living beings that we also know as mushrooms, yeasts, and mold, and which play an important role both as food and medicine, and occasionally, of course, as causes of disease. In fact, they are just ubiquitous. They are parts of our world that we have never really, Western culture in particular, has never really cottoned on to as in terms of how important they are for just about everything. Now, we talked before about your progression from harvesting wild mushrooms as a boy with your foraging uncle to then studying agriculture for your bachelor's degree and fungi, that's officially the study of mycology, for your master's degree, and then finally immersing yourself in education in general for your PhD. Now, after all that education about fungi and mushrooms, I have to ask you this question. I'm sure the audience is, our listeners are burning to know the answer. Did you ever eat a mushroom that made you unwell?
Oh my goodness. Warren, you know, I have a story to tell you if I may. This was many years ago. I was living in British Columbia, mm-hmm. doing my master's degree. And at the time I had a girlfriend from the Kootenays, mm-hmm. And her mother, so at that time, my informal mother-in-law, I don't know what I would, my relationship officially would be to her. Anyway, she was coming over, and my girlfriend's best friend, they were all coming over for a visit, for supper. And I like to cook. And I'm also
I have a sense of the direction of this story.
I probably shouldn't even be telling it. It kind of discredits me, but at the same time, it's entertaining in hindsight.
Yes.
The day before I'd harvested bags full of chicken of the woods, which is Leptiporus sulfurius or Polyporus sulfurius, and it's a very beautiful mushroom. You know, it's a conk. It grows on the sides of trees, and has this gorgeous yellow orange color, and presumably tastes like chicken. Hence the name. And so, you know, I picked a bunch of this and I thought, oh, I'll make a special meal for
they're going to love me for this.
They're going to love me. They're going to love me. So finally I'll be accepted. I had this cookbook that actually my girlfriend's mother had given me, and it was a gourmet mushroom cookbook. And there was this fantastic recipe for, it was skewered chicken of the woods on a hazelnut sauce on a bed of couscous. So I made this meal. I painstakingly made this meal with my very own hands that had collected the very same mushrooms the day before. And you know, I didn't really pay a whole lot of attention to what the mushroom was growing on. I didn't really think that was a big deal. Turns out it was. And so this edible mushroom caused half of the dinner attendees to be violently, like this was like the deck of the Titanic. I mean, we're talking like projectile vomiting in every direction.
And
you know, what made me feel even worse about this is that I, the so-called mushroom expert, was one of the, you know, one of the people that did not get sick.
Oh my Lord. This is the devil at work.
yeah, definitely some trickster energy. And so it turns out it was growing on cedar, and cedar's rich in thujone, which is, of course, you know, metabolized into some other toxin that our systems can't handle, and that's the theory anyway. The rest is ancient history.
Thank
goodness.
May the Great Spirit be with you and protect you from all mushroom errors in the future.
Oh my goodness! Yeah.
Good Lord.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I tell you, this is true confessions. You have told this story to a vast audience around the world. Well, we hope, we wish. But at least it's clear now that you are like the rest of us. You are just another human being who sometimes gets it wrong.
Well, it's a work in progress, I'll tell you that.
So. Well, join the club. It's a big club. Now, we're going to delve into the world of fungi and mushrooms in more depth shortly. But first, let's spend a little bit of time talking about the life of a distant learning professor at Athabasca University. And I want to remind listeners that Athabasca University is located in a small town, 145 kilometers north of Edmonton. It was founded in 1970 and teaches almost entirely through distance education. In fact, it was one of the first repositories of this mode of learning. In 2001, the university established the Center for World Indigenous Knowledge and Research called Nukshkatawin, whose goal is to, quote, support, protect, and preserve Indigenous knowledge, education, and oral traditions. It's obviously an important institution in sort of the world of learning, and especially the world of learning about Indigenous ways. Why don't you talk a little bit about the daily life of an Athabasca professor who's 3,000 kilometers away from the institution, because what's your daily routine when it comes to the university?
Thanks so much for asking, Warren. I would say, I mean, I've only been working there for about 8 months, maybe. So I haven't completed a full year cycle. And I think, you know, much of my day is spent marking, addressing student issues, responding to emails. I fit research and service in where I can. So, you know, in terms of the service piece, I'm on the Oregon Psilocybin Advisory Board, also work with a journal, Agriculture Community Development, I also sit on the Athabasca Press Committee, Editorial Committee, so that takes some time. Mm-hmm. Research is a big part of what I do. So that's I spend, you know, whenever I can squeeze in a bit of time doing some writing or reading and thinking, talking to people, I do that. It's a lot of time sitting. So I try to get up whenever possible and move around a bit, mm-hmm. whether that's inside the house or outside the house. Mm-hmm. During the swimming season, whenever it's high tide, I rush over to the beach and jump in. So that's another very important
aspect. The Atlantic
aspect
Ocean for listeners who cannot see the ocean that you're looking at when you're on the beach.
Yeah, the frigid Atlantic. Yeah.
Do you have like designated students that are your responsibility?
I do. Yeah, I do.
Is it a large number? I mean, it's a long. Are they all over the country or?
They are. Yeah, and it's typically. I think the typical load is something like 30 students at any given time all year, and the students tend to be mostly from Ontario and Alberta. But there certainly are students here in Nova Scotia and other parts of the world as well. Mm-hmm. And I'm really excited about our MAIS program, which is a Master's of Arts in interdisciplinary studies, and it's a really exciting program. And one of the very few master's degrees in Canada, from my experience, that offers prior learning assessment and recognition as a non-traditional option for admittance. So for instance, if you have rich life experience but no formal undergraduate degree, you can get into a master's degree in this interdisciplinary studies at Athabasca, which I think is really, you know, it's really fantastic. And there are so many people that just didn't have the opportunity to do an undergrad, but they've got the brain power and the determination to do it. What a fantastic option for them.
Yeah, it's sort of bypassing the prejudice against somebody who doesn't have a lot of letters after their name. I've known so many people as a physician in a small community, known so many people who are absolutely brilliant and have knowledge, sometimes esoteric knowledge, of all sorts of disciplines, but they didn't do it in a formal way. And they just get shoved to the side, you know, in general terms. And the fact that that's not happening is very heartening to hear that the human race is coming to recognize there's lots of different ways to learn.
Yeah, so true. So true. Yeah. And I just, it's exciting to me because, you know, I've got a number of friends who are in that kind of position or a colleague. You know, I'd love to see them have access to higher like graduate level studies, you know, and not have to jump through all the hoops.
That's right.
Getting an undergrad at, you know, the age of 40 something and whatnot.
Now, one of the other things you were telling me you're doing is working with a clinical herbalist in California. Why didn't you talk about that a little bit? Because that's an interesting story.
Sure. Yeah. You know, I'm working with my colleague, Dr. Laura Starfy, who's he's the director of the psychedelic assisted therapy program at the California Institute for Integral Studies.
Oh yes, I remember that. Remember that now. I just remind listeners once again that I'm speaking with Keith Williams, who's an assistant professor of educational studies at Athabasca University. And so what kind of work are you doing, you and your herbalist colleague?
Yeah, well, actually, Laura's an environmental philosopher, and her expertise is on developing this arboreal ethics, which is super fascinating. And the herbalist colleague is Andréanne Bédard, and she lives here in Nova Scotia, and she's a brilliant clinical herbalist. And so what we're doing is we're looking at this concept, inner healing intelligence, and that was named by I believe by Stanislav Grof, who
sure.
is
worked with LSD, mm-hmm. Realms of the Unconscious. I can't remember what the title of his book was. I've read it, the main book that he wrote. Interesting work.
I thought so too. Yeah, and so much of his work hinges on this idea of inner healing intelligence, which is in essence, as you know, from what I can see, is a kind of rebranded vitalism, essentially. Okay. And if you had to define it, I think he defines it as something along the lines of you know, all of us have this innate capacity and an innate inclination to move towards health.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So,
sorry, go ahead.
I'll just say something really quickly. And so so the notion of inner healing intelligence is foundational, central to psychedelic assisted therapy, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. but it's woefully under theorized. So this is what we're trying to get in there and take a closer look at it and trying to really flesh the idea out more deeply so that it can be of better use.
Yeah. So you can talk about it with other people and have a kind of a vocabulary to describe what's going on. One thing we talked about, which is kind of related to this, is the notion of plant. We were talking about how shamans and healers in indigenous cultures could understand what plants can do, what the properties of plants are. And the notion of plant teachers, which is a wonderful sort of reciprocal notion of our relationship with growing things, plants in particular. Do you want to just talk about that a little bit? It's a beautiful idea. I mean, it's not an idea. It's a beautiful reality.
Yeah, I think so too, Warren. And, you know, I think that that idea is commonly associated with Amazonian indigenous knowledge, and specifically around plant medicines, including but not limited to the ayahuasca admixture ingredient, plant mm-hmm. ingredients.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that, again, the idea is that these plants communicate with us and share knowledge and wisdom that you know then can help to improve our. And so it's, I think from my understanding, it can be both active and passive. I think a good example of plant intelligence is what the traditional healers in the Amazon say, from what I understand, that when you, let me back up for a second. Western scientists recognize, I think, maybe one species, maybe two or three variants of subspecies of Banisteriopsis capi, which is the ayahuasca vine or the yahe vine.
Mm-hmm.
Indigenous peoples recognize over a dozen.
Hmm.
And what they say is it basically when you eat the plant tells you that they learned it by eating them.
Hmm.
And the plant then communicated that information.
This is what we're talking about or getting into is the fact that plants can have medicinal roles and roles on consciousness, but they're also food. And this kind of interrelationship between plants that heal in a way that we recognize as healing, mm-hmm. but also plants that simply supply us with, well, I don't want to say it simply, that supplies with nutritional value and allow us to survive and live and function. Of course, in Western medicine, there's the notion that Hippocrates is famous for enunciating, which is, let your food be your medicine and your medicine be your food, which is like he might have talked to some indigenous people at that point. But it's the barricade between food and medicine in what we're talking about now is really a bit of an illusion. It depends on what you're looking for from the food you consume, the plant food you consume, because both are possible and they can even happen simultaneously. You know, you can have a healing effect and a nutritional value simultaneously. And I guess those distinctions are less important in indigenous teachings. Would I be right in thinking that? They do all their things. They do whatever they do, rather than being defined as, you know, just food or just healing or whatever.
Yeah, I think there's a good point there. I also, from my understanding as well, I mean, certain medicines have very specific protocols around how they should be harvested and then consumed. And I think that separates them from day-to-day food, but mm-hmm. that might make them a little bit more aligned with or similar to ceremonial food, for instance.
Sure. Sure.
So yeah, I think there's a lot there, definitely. But you know, it makes me think of when I was younger. I'd worked up in northern BC in a Dene community, and one of the elders there would every day take a shot of soapberry juice, and he was in his 90s at the time, he said basically he attributed his longevity to this the blood purifying properties of soapberry, Chippewa canadensis.
It's so hard to argue with a 90-year-old. And say, well, we're not sure if that's really true, sir, or madam.
I wouldn't dare.
No, indeed. Stay away from that. Now, fungi, the whole world of fungi, of mushrooms, which we, you know, conventionally talk about mushrooms when they're food, and we talk about other things when they're sort of ceremonial or psychedelic. But they bridge all of these kingdoms, you know, or qualities. They offer nutritional, you know, vitamins, minerals, etc. They offer unique compounds that have healing properties, and then they have mind-altering properties. In a way, they are, you know, sort of the ultimate crossover plant form that does just about everything, depending on where it's found, and it's found everywhere. So it's the fungi are found everywhere. Is mm-hmm. that what was that? Part of why, I mean, apart from the fact that you had an uncle who acquainted you with the world of mushrooms, but Is that part of what has drawn you to this class of living things?
Well, you know, it's probably what's kept me interested in fungi for sure, you know, and they're just, and that diversity that you speak to, you know, you see that on multiple, like it's almost like fractal, you know, there's so many levels in which fungi are so diverse, whether it's, you know, life history strategies, whether it's their, you know, evolutionary relationships with animals, whether it's, their forms that they take. But I think for me, you know, it's my initial interest in fungi was really, it's really far simpler than that. It was because they're so curious and beautiful. That was the original.
The attraction. It's interesting. Yeah. There's a video about mushrooms. I can't remember the name of it, but it's on one of the popular distribution systems, and it has a lot of time-lapse photography. And it's absolutely astonishing when you sort of accelerate the rate of development of the fruiting bodies, which we call mushrooms, and to see them just in their diversity and how they just expand and grow out of Tom's, my engineer is telling me it's Netflix for those listeners who'd like to see it. and in fact, that's, I remember where we watched it. And it really illustrates the incredible diversity and color and shape and size. Now, in indigenous culture, there's a different use for, let's talk about the psychedelics for a moment. There's a trend in Western medicine to use individual mushrooms for therapies of particular conditions. And it's all, and with psychedelics, it's expansion of your consciousness so you can become a better person. But there's a very different slant from what I understand of our conversations. In indigenous culture, they are expected to play a very different kind of role, not just for individuals.
Yeah. And are you speaking specifically of psychoactive fungi or fungi more broadly?
Yes, specifically because they played such a prominent role in so many cultures around the world.
Well, yeah, it's a really good point. And, you know, Warren, I would say from my understanding, and this extends even beyond psychoactive fungi to psychedelics more broadly, peyote and ayahuasca and some of the others, they're typically consumed in a collective setting, and I think for the purpose of collective healing in some cases, but I think that collectivity is very much like similar to how most indigenous ceremonies are conducted, and I think it speaks to, I think, this underlying difference between Western and indigenous, Western being more focused on the individual and indigenous being a little bit more community or collective oriented.
Isn't it interesting how we've drifted away from, in industrial societies, extractivist societies, away from the notion of doing something for the community? I believe Ayn Rand said she said something about not charity, but that if you look about into the interests of other people, it's she called it poison in the lifeblood of democracy. And I'm it's sad to say that her writings have become sort of necessary reading for many American politicians in particular. And it's such a reversal of the cultural values and the essence of what indigenous communities tended to avow, which was that everything you do for the community. You do not step outside the community. Now, there were conflicts between different communities and different nations, but within the nation itself, there was this profound emphasis on doing for others what you don't just do for yourself, you do for others. That do you want to just expand on that a little bit?
Sure. I guess the first thing I would say is that that indigenous notions of collectivity, extend way beyond even extant humans. So, for instance, to include all our relations, and that can include ancestors and future ancestors, like the future generations, plants, animals, water, the rock, the rivers, the spirits. So I think that's it. You know, it's sort of like collectivism sense in the broad sense, in a very broad sense. Yeah. And I think if you go back far enough in any culture, Western or otherwise, you'll probably find something very similar. And it would be, I think it would be very interesting to trace the kind of that particular genealogy of loss.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd remind listeners again, I'm speaking with Keith Williams, who's an assistant professor of educational studies at Athabasca University. Now, speaking sort of all our relations and this interconnectedness between all life forms, we touched briefly a moment ago on vitalism, which is sort of, it's almost like Western science attempt to admit that there was something going on in living things that was beyond chemistry and physics. And I looked up some kind of formal definition of what vitalism was all about. And this was from an article. It said, during the 19th century, the vitalists, this is when the sort of idea became sort of advanced and more prominent, the vitalists mm-hmm. believed that life processes were controlled by their own sui generis laws, in other words, laws unique to them, while mechanists believed that these processes were controlled by the laws of physics and chemistry. In other words, the giant watch notion of living things, they're just more complicated watches than the watches that we use on our walls and that kind of thing. And this is such a profoundly important thing that in a way has always been central to indigenous thought and commentary and ideas. Do you want to explain why we've gone awry in the capitalist extractivist world?
Yeah, I mean I'm not really sure why we've gone awry, to be honest. I suspect, you know, it probably has something to do with what you gestured, and that's, you know, the sort of rise of global capitalism. And you know, if we're all independent objects existing without connection to one another or a vital life force, then we can be more vulnerable to and dependent on, vulnerable to disease and dependent on external cure. So I suspect that politics could be part of it, but I also think there are probably broader ideological things happening. I suspect. But yeah, it's super interesting. And I think it was Henri Bergson who was one of the people that initiated this turn to vitality in the late 19th, early 20th century. And his notion, élan vital, was
yes.
I found that very interesting. I found it very compelling. Mm-hmm. I haven't read a whole lot about it. It's my colleague, Andréane Bédard, who's writing that section of the upcoming paper. but
takes your own job.
yeah. But then, of course, you know, we'll have to be comfortable with it, the whole thing as a collective. But yeah, it is interesting. And I think one of his primary arguments was that, you know, if the world were mechanical in orientation, then strictly mechanical, then we could undo evolution. You could take it apart, go back, you know, take it apart and you know, put it back together, reassemble it from mm-hmm. its constituent parts. But yeah. We know that that's, I don't even know if that's theoretically possible. So,
you know, it's kind of like saying a beautiful work of art, let's just kind of cut up into little bits and throw it up in the air and then reassemble it in a slightly different image. It doesn't make any sense. And, you know, it only makes sense in the abstract. When you actually think about doing it in the concrete world, it doesn't make any sense at all. And in tied into this is the notion of the sacredness of all life forms. Again, something that is inherent in many indigenous teachings and seems so far away from, you know, how can you line a bunch of cows up at an abattoir on a ramp and have them come in and whack them on the head, and while they're still alive, dismember them and make them into steaks. When you see these creatures, these living beings, as sacred, it's I can't conceive of it right now. Help me, Keith. What's gone wrong in our way of looking at things?
Well, you know, it's a great example, and I think a big part of that is, you know, I have a conversation coming up with a couple of friends next week sometime, and we're talking about the synthetic sacred. That'll be the topic of conversation. very provocative. And so, you know, I was thinking to myself, well, what is it that makes something sacred? What is that? And I think there are a few things. I won't get into all of them right now, but one of the things that really hit me was, I mean, you know, the kind of fundamental ethical concern for humanity, I feel, is coming to terms with the fact that we need to take life to have life. And I think that, you know, in terms of, like the indigenous hunters that I know, I don't hunt. I should probably, but, I don't. But in terms of the traditional hunters that I know, I mean, there are really beautiful and profound, like ceremonial activities involved in the hunt. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the most amazing, amazing things that people do. And it's just, it's beautiful. It's complex. And it's, and people are right there living with that struggle every time they take a life.
Yes.
And that's, you know, that's part of that traditional way of being, that traditional life. And I just think so many of us have strayed from that. And I think, you know, when there's that dissonance between what we know to be true in our hearts and the way that we live our lives, I think that that's, you know, it's things like that that I think make us sick, really.
Yes. I think it generates pathology because there's enough congruence between ourselves as living and animals, and we're now rediscovering that rich relationship between us and other life forms, which when we were talking and in a paper which we're going to talk a little bit that you wrote co-wrote about our more than human kin, you know, the conventional view in Western industrial society is that we are the superior being and all other creatures are lower on the order of meaning and value than we are. But talking about more than human recognizes the fact that many life forms have properties that we don't have and we cannot exercise because they're not part of us. The hearing sense of many animals is incredibly acute compared to ours. All sorts of things like that. I mean, more than human seems to make so much sense.
I think so too. And you know, it's when I think about indigenous teachings, traditional teachings for the Haudenosaunee, you know, we believe that humans are the weakest link in the chain of life, and that we were, you know, created last. And we, you know, and part of our folly is that we, you know, we don't realize that, and we've inverted that pyramid, you know.
Let's talk about a paper that you shared with me just recently. In fact, it was just published on February the 5th, 2024, which is pretty recent. The title of this is Should Sacred Plant Medicines Have Standing, you know, Impact Standing, The Original Instructions and Western Jurisprudence. Now, there's a lot to explore in that title. There are terms and significances that we need to take apart. But it's interesting, your co-author is a lawyer, not a biologist. She's involved with Harvard Law School, and she helps to publish a blog called The Bill of Health, which is about health law and policy. And I wonder if, because she also has an indigenous background from, I believe it's another sort of Eastern Canada-based community. I think you must have known her before you were, you know, like come across. It was this is not an that's, you looked her up in the dictionary. It was more like, or the people who were interested. How did you get to know her? I mean, because it's a fascinating paper.
Actually, she contacted me. She was putting together, she's co-founder, Ariel Clark is co-founder of Psychedelic Bar Association.
Indeed.
She is, she's just an amazing human being, so intelligent, and she's really walking on the red road, I would say. Like she's, you know, she takes her tradition very seriously, and she's a great person. So she reached out to me. She was putting together a panel of people who write about or think about indigenous knowledge and psychedelics. And so I was one of the people that she invited. And so, so we met that way, and then just the conversation off, and we got along so well, and one thing led to the next, and we prepared this this short paper.
It's interesting that even in the Western media, in the sort of conventional media, Rolling Stone magazine named her as one of 18 women shaping the culture of tomorrow.
No. Oh, you're kidding. Oh, that's great.
I read up.
That's
fantastic.
That's Ariel Clark. Oh, that's fantastic. I had no idea. I had no idea. When was that? Wow. She's really, really great. She's an amazing person. So I'm not surprised.
Yeah. Well, it's wow. She's within the legal world. She's well known, and she's one of the things she's known for is advocating for a different relationship with cannabis. But but that's only part of what she does. And interesting in this organization you're mentioning, the Psychedelic Bar Association, which is lawyers who are trying to bring a broader and more profound relationship to the use of psychedelics than just here, take this and it'll, you know, help you get over your alcoholism, that kind of thing. And she's on the religious use committee of the Psychedelic Bar Association, which seems to me, you know, taking seriously this notion of sacred plants, of them not just being, whether they're for food or whether for medicine or whether they have psychedelic properties, it's acknowledging that they are part of the deepest values that we relate to in our world. And that must have resonated with you.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. Yeah.
By the way, did you ever meet David Boyd? David Boyd is the guy, he's a Canadian lawyer. But he's very involved with the rights of nature movement.
We
actually were very happy to have him as the final speaker in a conference we did on the climate crisis. And he's a lovely guy. He's got a great mustache. It's about a yard and a half long. And he wrote a book called The Rights of Nature, A Legal Revolution That Could Save the World. It seems to me that Western thinking is getting closer and closer and closer to absorbing, and not even absorbing, but being enriched by indigenous understanding of these kinds of issues.
Yeah, I think so. And you know what's heartening to me is that much of the kind of grassroots legislation that's coming out around rights of nature is coming from tribal communities, typically in the U.S. So I find that really heartening. But you know, and I should back up and say I had not heard of David Boyd, but I will look that work up because I must, and I'm very curious about the mustache as well.
Well, you know, speaking to somebody with a very large mustache, you have to, sometimes it's better to hear them than to speak to them because you see it moving around. But he's
a distraction.
He's approached the United Nations to try and move towards an acknowledgement that Mother Nature, Pachamama, the natural world, has rights, and that's in fact a very profound concept that you explored in your paper with Ariel Clark. It seems to me that for example, in 2018, and you mentioned this in your paper, wild rice, an Ojibwe white earth band of wild rice in Minnesota had for the first time their rice given sacred status. It seems to me that's the kind of thing we're sort of circulating around this fundamental issue that the natural world is as important as we are, and we are just one small part of it.
Well, exactly. Yeah. And what hearing you say that, and it reinforces my own, you know, my own understanding that way. But yes, it brings to mind one of the main challenges that I guess I have with the rights of nature approach, and to draw on Audre Lorde's famous quotation, you know, you cannot use the master's tool to dismantle the master's house. You know, I just wonder to what extent, like how far can the rights of nature take us? And I think this is where I'm really interested in incorporating the original instructions into rights of nature. Like that's, you know, natural law, you know. So I think that's, to me, that's really fascinating and provocative. But can it still have a positive effect despite, you know, this on like this Western monolith of the legal system?
Well, Western monoliths can be altered. I speaking as a member of the Western monolith, I can say I think it can be altered. Once again, I'm speaking with Keith Williams, who's assistant professor of educational studies at Athabasca University. So I read your paper. The paper, Should Sacred Plant Medicines Have Standing? The Original Instructions in Western Jurisprudence. And a number of things, I found it a very rich document because it contains some, I think, profoundly important concepts and ideas and perspectives. And you start off by talking about the psychedelic renaissance and the use of plant medicines for consciousness change. Mm. And you said the psychedelic renaissance, like its namesake, the European Renaissance, is only possible because of the underlying extractivist colonial logic informing activity in this domain. And you and Ariel Clark point to your indigenous background and say, we have a profound interest in respecting, honoring, and becoming with our more than human kin. That's where I got that phrase, more than human kin. Do you want to just describe how that interest manifests, or how it's embedded in indigenous thinking?
Sure. Well, you know what you had mentioned earlier about human exceptionalism, I think, and then contrasting that with the indigenous approach, which you know, these humans is one of, you know, one of many, many beings that live on the land. I think that, you know, that sort of at the heart of it, that speaks to, you know, an indigenous relationality more broadly with the world around us, and it informs everything, really. Central to indigenous spiritual traditions is this recognition that we're related to, we depend on, and are dependent on by everything the rest of the world around us.
You in your paper, you point out that this is sort of a global notion. It's not just something limited to, say, the Americas, but for example, in the South Pacific, in India, Bolivia, South American countries like Bolivia, Ecuador, and Colombia, this insight is creeping into Western enactments. For example, in Ecuador, enshrining the rights of nature, or as they call Pachamama, into the constitution. I mean, there's a formal declaration in the Constitution itself that says nature has the right to integral respect for its existence and for the maintenance and regeneration of its life cycle, structure, functions, and evolutionary process. I mean, I remember when that enactment took place, it sent a little shot around the world, as they say. Mm-hmm. But this is part of the change, is it not?
I think so. And I think, as you said earlier, you know, that there is hope that we can change the kind of these Western cultural institutions that, you know, seem to behave as monoliths. And perhaps, you know, at the constitutional level, at the municipal policy and bylaw level, the provincial and national level, you know, these are things that we can, you know, we can do to help chip away at that already crumbling edifice.
Yes, already crumbling. I like that phrase because it seems accurate when you look at what's going on in the world today. Now, yes, and we haven't even mentioned Gaza or Ukraine or a whole bunch of other things that are going on in the world. In the title, there's a reference to the original instructions. Why don't you describe what constitute the original instructions in indigenous culture?
Well, I mean, I think it's formulated a little bit differently by different peoples, but generally it's this idea that the you know, creation or the creator or the great spirit or however you want to frame that, gave humanity, gave all of creation these guidelines for right livelihood, right living. Mm-hmm. And I think for my understanding, you know, our responsibility is to adhere to those guidelines, but also to support other creatures and other organisms in their ability to meet their own responsibilities to creation.
And that term responsibilities with respect to other life forms, it's a profoundly revealing concept. In other words, that other life forms have a role. They play a role. They are designated to play a role. They are not simply automatons or creatures just sleepwalk through life. And you describe it in your paper as part of our role as humans is to ensure that we do not compromise the personhood of other beings. That's in line with what you said earlier about humans being created last and kind of bit of a misfit, which needs a lot of instruction. Our species needs a lot of help to get on track. Is that what you're referring to when you talk about this, the original instructions? They are necessary learning.
I would say so. Yeah. And I mean, I think this is why, you know, we talked about it perhaps on the last visit. You know, this is why I think we have so many trickster stories. It's because, you know, that we tend to stray from those original instructions. We are the misfits, and we need those stories to help bring us back to remind us of what we already knew.
One of the sentences in your paper that I highlighted in yellow and bold, it's a question. And the question is this: can an extractivist medicalized model, which is referring to plant uses for medicine and fungi in particular, can an extractivist medicalized model yield collective and planetary healing that is needed at this time of climate crisis, mass extinctions, loss of habitats and ecosystem functions, global conflict, and rising inequality? Well, of course, the answer in my mind is immediately no, but maybe you could comment on what you were getting at in that point there.
Sure. Well, and I guess my thought there is that you can't deny that individuals can obtain benefits or realize benefits from sacred plant medicines or psychedelic compounds, in clinical, medicalized, commercialized settings. There's no question. I don't believe that the full potential of these medicines for collective and planetary healing is possible according to the current sort of status quo business as usual approach.
Yeah. You do add a little later on another question, and that is there room within or adjacent to the Western legal tradition for the original instructions to recognize these sacred medicines as persons and kin? And again, I would broaden it because the paper was focusing to some degree on psychedelic plants, but also you could include all life forms in this, the life forms that we use for food, whether they're plant or animal, the ones we have for companionship. It seems that the original instructions are pretty original, like they precede some of the legal forms that we rely on, you know, like laws about, you know, drinking and driving and stuff like that. Way beyond that, there are rules about how we relate to every other living thing on the planet.
It's true. And, you know, one thing I've heard from elders is something along the lines of, you know, you can break the law, you can avoid the law, you can dissimulate, you can cheat your fate in that way.
I only had two beer, officer.
That sort of thing. Oh, look at my my breathalyzer isn't working today. I guess you're off the hook. You know, I mean, so you can do that, but not when it comes to natural law or the original instruction. You know, that will, like, there's no mercy. It's not even a matter of mercy. It just happened.
Yes.
You know, you break those laws and that's it. The, you know, actions, reactions and consequences.
I was relieved when I got to the end of your paper that you actually did answer the questions that I was laying out earlier. you said that the profound healing needed at this moment in our planetary history can only be achieved through respectful and compassionate reciprocal relationships with the more than human, including the medicines. That sounds like it's ultimately hopeful, Keith.
Oh, definitely, definitely. Yeah. And same with food. As you said earlier, I mean, this applies to food, to animals we keep, pets or livestock, all of it.
Yeah, we're obviously on a trajectory in that direction. You said earlier that you don't hunt, but you said, maybe I should. why don't you describe that? Because I've much greater respect for people who hunt for meat than people who go to the grocery store and buy a steak in a, you know, a plastic wrap that without any thought really about the origin of that meat. So talk about how hunting is different.
Yeah, well, you know, I love to garden. So I garden every year and you know, a big garden. And having that connection with the plant food is really important to me. And it informs my eating and how I, you know, how I engage with the food on the plate and in the kitchen. I think with animals, hunting animals, you know, I mean, you know, I guess I just feel like if it's, you know, if I'm going to eat meat, you know, it's probably important to have that ethical struggle, you know, and really when we think about it, if that is essentially, you know, that recognition or reconciliation of knowing that we have to kill in order to live, if that's fundamentally one of the fundamental things that makes us human, like, what are we cheating ourselves of if we don't give ourselves that opportunity to learn in that way and to grapple with that core fundamental human issue or condition?
Yes, it's widely accepted that individuals who abuse others often begin abusing others, even to the point of killing them, by starting with animals. Their initial path down this dark road is in that respect.
Wow.
Do you see progress? Do you see that we're moving? We're starting to move in a direction that we can all feel good with?
Well, I hope so. You know, I mean, there's, you know, there are, you know, increasingly people are talking about the rights of animals and animal sentience, plant sentience even, and vegetal ethics, you know, so these things are on the horizon in certain domains. And I think eventually, you know, and they are finding their way into the mainstream discourse. And once stuff is out there, it's out there. At the same time, I see us in this present moment in which, you know, we're probably, you know, we spend so much time talking about sustainability, but we're probably living in the least sustainable way that we have as a race of beings on this planet ever, you know, and it's like, you know, I don't know if you've noticed this, but over the past probably 15 years, there's been this huge increase, maybe even 20 in the discourse around accountability, you know, and safety. And so much of that is interesting. Like, we talk about it, we use those words so much, yet we live in a time where nobody seems to be accountable for anything. So I guess I feel like we are moving in a good direction in terms of that discourse, but I just caution, I'm cautious that, you know, that it may just be, you know, words that don't necessarily translate into.
Yes, we have trickster minds that can lead us down the wrong path, and it sometimes is a long time before we wake up. Keith Williams, it's been, again, a delight to have you on Food Conversations. Your articulate expression of values and principles, I can see that your students are lucky to have you as their educator, and I'm sure your graduates will be all over the world changing things. Thank you very much. Not at all. It was a pleasure, and thank you for being with us again today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you, Warren.